Okay, it is the 8th of September, and this is the third privacy class. I have some things I want to talk about tonight. You know, the topic is the privacy in the digital age, kind of repetitious here, and talk a little bit tonight about, in more detail, about some of the digital privacy laws that we have. But before I do, I have some news stories as recent as this afternoon. I was wondering if any of you, now that you're taking this class, spotted something of interest privacy-wise that you'd be interested in sharing with the class? Privacy law, any experiences, things that made you go, No? Okay, well, let me share a couple from today from the New York Times. This is an article from today's Times, released today's Times Online. Medical privacy breach led to the public posting on a commercial website of data for 200,000 emergency room patients at Stanford Hospital in Palo Alto, including names and diagnosis codes, the hospital has confirmed. The information stayed online for nearly a year. Since discovering the breach last month, the hospital has been investigating how a detailed spreadsheet made its way from one of the vendors, a billing contractor identified as Multi-Specialty Collection Services, to a website called Student of Fortune, which allows students to solicit paid assistance with their schoolwork. Gary Migdol, a spokesman for Stanford Hospital and Clinics, said the spreadsheet first appeared on the site on September 9, 2010, as an attachment to a question on how to convert the data to a bar graph. So it wasn't. Think about this. Let's try to place this out. Let's try to parse this out, because this really encapsulates, I think, the challenges of privacy in the digital age. They had a billing contractor, that is, the hospital did. It had data. Makes sense. 200,000 emergency room patients. It appears that someone working for Multi-Specialty Collection Services wanted to convert the data to a bar graph. Didn't know how to do that, and posted the question to Student of Fortune, which allows students to solicit paid assistance with their schoolwork. What do you do with that? Just imagine you are counsel for the hospital. The previous counsel for the hospital. What do you do with that? Well, first of all, let's start with who would be the claimant here? Who's your plaintiff in your hypothetical? Would it be the hospital or would it be the patients?
It conceivably could be both.
Okay, so please go ahead, but just want to.
Because the claim would be against Multi-Specialty Collection Services.
Right. I'm not sure that the hospital has a claim per se for privacy.
Well, I'm not saying that they do, but I'm asking a question.
The answer is I don't know. And where you would look, generally speaking, is state and federal law, something like, for example, the HIPAA privacy rules, and whether they provide for a private right of action. So, in a vacuum, I can't answer the question. You'd have to look specifically there. You might also look for California-specific rights to privacy and whether those have been violated. Now, what's the claim that the hospital could make? You're now counsel for the hospital. You're presented with this story. Your board of directors is going nuts. What does that presuppose?
That they had an obligation to keep your information that prior that they had a non-disclosure.
Right.
Of
which means, in order to have that, what would the counsel for the hospital have to have done in advance of this?
Contracted with the multi-specialty to have other privacy rules.
Right. This is why we're teaching this class. So that when your clients come to you and say, we're going to be doing a deal with a collection service, the hospital or anybody else, what should go into the sorry, I just got this new thing and I'm learning its little foibles. What should go into the contract? One of the things you want to remember is obligation to keep something confidential. Non-disclosure. Whatever you want to call it, in the body of the contract. The data we are providing to you are confidential. You must keep it confidential. Now, here is one very key practice point. Real world lawyering point. Just like, well, many other things, one cannot prevent breaches of confidentiality. One can prohibit them. One can penalize them. One cannot prevent it. There was nothing, once the hospital gave its data to the collection service, there was nothing the hospital could do to prevent this breach. It could say, it's a breach of contract. Here are the penalties. If we get sued because you have breached the contract, you will hereby indemnify us, multi-collection services. What, you didn't bring enough for everybody? But if this were a commercial, snow or something would come out. So the contract needs to be there, and it needs to be correct. There need to be sufficient financial penalties, both for the direct breach and the indemnification, but there too. What if multi-specialty collection services has no money? Or not enough money to indemnify, to pay the hospital back for the 20,000 suits it's about to face, or the class action suit with 20,000 named plaintiffs? What then? What does the hospital need?
Bond, insurance.
Insurance. It needs, ideally, to obligate this company to have insurance, to back up its financial obligations under the contract, and the hospital needs its own insurance, but does a hospital's standard insurance policy cover this? What would a hospital's standard insurance cover? It's a hospital. What do you think? What? What a hospital have insurance against? Malpractice. What else? Business practices, the hospital's business practices.
Could conceivably.
Right. Another practice point, and one that comes up really every relationship, every business you're consulting with. Does its insurance cover these risks? New media, internet-based risks, technology-related risks? Probably, if the insurance policy has not been looked at, for some time, no.
So are you saying that you're not, or you just haven't, are you aware in any instance that the harm, there has to be harm?
I'm not opining one way or the other. That is a legal research question. I don't know specifically what California law may provide in terms of rights of action, whether there needs to be demonstrated harm or whether simply the breach of privacy might in itself grant someone damages. I don't know off the top of my head whether HIPAA's privacy rules grant a private right of action to patients in this situation. So I don't know. That's clearly a question that lawyers for these people would have to ask. But the business's lawyer, Stanford Hospital's lawyers, are going to be dealing with this crisis in a lot of different ways. It'll be dealing with it, what its contract says, what its insurance says. This is a PR disaster. They're going to need to do reputation management, crisis management. This is a problem. Particularly where? Where is this happening? This is not happening in Topeka or in Central Islip. This is happening at Stanford Hospital in Palo Alto, California. Go try to convince a jury in Palo Alto that Stanford Hospital should not be held to a high level of understanding about technology. Talk about a reputation problem. So while we will discuss health privacy a little later on in the semester, including, and we'll come back to it, so what? What is the damage? Let's assume for a moment that the statute may or may not, whatever it is, talk about pecuniary money damages. How have the patients potentially been harmed? What does it matter that their visits to the emergency room and their diagnoses were made public? So what? Where's the harm? Where's the harm? Why is this a problem?
Maybe you could get out what if they're trying to find, you know, insurance for something else, you know, for them. Maybe that test diagnosis with something would get out to these carriers or even maybe future employers or something like that, that they know these people have a certain problem. You never know where the information can lead to.
And what if it does? What might happen with these people if it gets to a potential insurer or a potential employer?
They could be denied, you know, any sort of coverage for them to find a job.
That would be entitled to claim that, because that would be something that they would prevent to get.
What about a job?
Under a job, that would, I don't think they can.
What if there was no obligation necessarily to disclose? It wasn't relevant, but an insurer looks at this person and says, oh, this person doesn't go to a primary care physician. I'm going to put him in a higher risk pool or rate differently. I won't hire you because you've got X condition. I won't rent to you. I'm not going to ask you the question because that's illegal. But I searched your name out in a public search engine. You can't prove it, but I'm not going to hire you because you've got some disfiguring, embarrassing condition. If you're not hired,
it's very hard to link, you know,
the
cause of action.
It absolutely would be difficult, except, you know, proving the negative is always hard. But that's the potential harm. Whether or not it's compensated, that's why health privacy matters. Because there are consequences in real life, whether there should be or not, And I will probably be giving you some of the cases. Health privacy is an area where there are some really, I think, important, useful cases, and I will probably be providing you with those citations and have you read those cases and we get to that discussion. But whether it's HIV positive status, certainly earlier when that was much more of A, a death sentence, and B, not that understood, there are cases about police action and employer action. And, you know, there are a lot of consequences, provable and otherwise. That's why this is more than embarrassing, because there's real harm potentially here. Not identity theft, per se. This is not one of those credit card numbers, social security numbers. But this is when they were in the hospital. Well, what did they tell their employer? You know, what conditions do they have? There are communities where family health history impacts on marriageability. Oh, your father had this, your mother had that. You never know. That's more than the law. That's a risk issue, but it's something why this matters beyond the embarrassment is because there are consequences. And the law may or may not provide adequate redress after the fact. That's why we have to think in advance. Another legal story from today, not even that long ago. See, this class is literally up to the minute, or at least up to 7:27 tonight. Senator Richard Blumenthal, Democrat of Connecticut, introduced a new bill today that aims to protect citizens' personal information from online data breaches. The bill would also punish companies that are careless with customers' information. Remember our discussion last class about BJ's? Where the FTC took upon itself, and I think you had had some concerns about that, Francis, right? That you felt that the FTC was overreaching in punishing BJ's for, look here, Senator Blumenthal is taking exactly the same approach. I don't know what the specifics are. We could read the bill. The Personal Data Protection and Breach Accountability Act comes at a time when online privacy and security are hot topics in Congress. See, we're trendy. Jobs, potentially. The bill presented by Senator Blumenthal would introduce regulations for companies that store online data for more than 10,000 people. These rules would require companies to follow specific storage guidelines and ensure that personal information is stored and protected correctly. Companies that do not adhere to these security guidelines could be subject to stiff fines. Is this a good idea? We can discuss it. But what the FTC did on a broader, because it had no, it's not that it didn't have a mandate, it has a huge mandate. The FTC has a mandate to protect consumers, and we're about to discuss some of those cases. But just as with COPPA, which we'll talk about, just as with children's privacy, Congress follows the lead of the FTC, follows the lead of the attorneys general, follows the lead of states to say that there need to be minimum standards for reasonability so that companies will take ordinary precautions and we will define them. I'm not so sure Congress is in the best position to do that, but note, this is not so far out of the, this is today, bill proposed, whether it will pass or not. So your impression that the FTC was maybe way out there last week, this is mainstream Congress today.
That was just my personal opinion.
That's fine. And
I did answer the question that I asked, so maybe I'll let everybody know. It appears that a public disclosure of private facts would be similar to libel and slander, but in that case, truth is not a defense for the invasion of privacy. So
we're back to what we were discussing last week.
It would be considered a disclosure. It's sort of its own offense.
Hold that thought. Get there, okay? We'll get there right now. Just to remind you, what did we discuss last time? So there was this article, this formative article, 1890, The Right to Privacy, looking at the law at the time, looking at the analogs of property, of defamation. But there, that's falsehood. That they didn't go far enough, and proposing, Warren and Brandeis did, this idea of to find a right within the law and establish it as long as the context was private. And we specifically looking at the abuses of the new technologies of 1890, of photography and telegraph, and etc. Now, what happened then? Here's the rest of the story, as the late Paul Harvey was like to say. 70 years later, we have another article in the California Law Review of Prosser, as in Prosser on torts, right? Very influential person. He looked, what happened? Well, what happened was, in the wake of Warren and Brandeis, by 1960, states had, in fact, codified four, generally speaking, four categories of privacy torts. intrusion upon seclusion or solitude, the right to be left alone, public disclosure of embarrassing facts, which I think is what you were just talking about. Some states do, some don't. Publicity placing a person in false light in the public eye, not defamation per se, but setting someone up so that it's an unfair characterization. Maybe true, but it's false by the public eye, and you have to look at that. Or, here's much more of a property right, appropriation of a person's name or likeness for another's benefit. Not surprisingly, California has very strong laws about that, because if you think about the entertainment industry and the celebrity industries, there's a very famous case which is often talked about in intellectual property classes of the letter turning robot. Do you remember this case?
Yeah.
Oh, you just talked about it. So you're taking up Lee Hechtel's class?
Yeah.
Oh, good. How's that going so far? Good. Whatever. She's a great person, and I'm sure you're all learning together, so you just talked about this class. Why don't you share? Is everyone in that class? Why don't you share, since you're up to date, tell them basically the facts of this case.
Facts of Vanna White, I don't know if you know or not. She's the co-hostess of Wheel of Fortune. She's the one that turns the letters on the big board. So Samsung ran a series of advertisements of what the future would be like in the early 21st century. And the longest running game show, but instead of using Vanna White, they used a robot that had the Vanna White hair, basically, with her wig, and standing in front of a board with the letters on it. So the issue was that Vanna White was claiming that they were using her likeness for this advertisement without her permission, and she had the right to privacy for that. And it seemed like people were thinking that she was endorsing the Samsung products when she really wasn't.
Right. Now, to understand this, this wasn't an android with Vanna White's face. This was a very metallic, very non-human looking robot with a blonde wig.
Kind of like a C-3PO with like a wig.
Right. Or if you've ever seen Spaceballs, the character that Joan Rivers voices. And it was successful, the case. It wasn't her name. It wasn't even her likeness in the sense of her face or her voice. It was her role and blonde hair. And in California, that was seen as sufficient. So these rights, maybe not by 1960, but certainly as of today, have gone very far. And if you want to understand them generally, you can look to the restatement. Now, the restatements are, of course, not law. As much as courts cite to them, the restatements are essentially teaching tools. General summaries with citations of legal principles. These are not enforceable. But what does the restatement 652B, second of torts, tell us? It defines this tort. Well, particularly this tort of intrusion, physically or otherwise, on the solitude or seclusion. This, and remember, just to give a sense of how this works out, this is sort of the weird one. I think we understand public disclosure of embarrassing facts, false light in the public eye, being publicized in a way that one didn't want, and this idea of likeness. What is intrusion upon seclusion? One who intentionally intrudes, physically or otherwise, upon the solitude or seclusion of another or his private affairs or concerns, is subject to liability to the other for invasion of his privacy if the intrusion would be highly offensive to a reasonable person. This is not the law in any particular state. This is a general summary of this tort as it is enacted in various states and with various words. So here are the elements, right? Intentional intrusion, physical or otherwise, be electronic, right? On the solitary seclusion of another or his private affairs or concerns, So this is an invasion of privacy if the intrusion would be highly offensive to a reasonable person. Those are the standards. Just understand that we do now have, in many states, these types of laws that were predicted, requested, suggested by Warren and Brandeis. Yeah.
So I guess the question in the prior example would hinge upon whether or not the act of going out and attempting to solicit somebody to help them would otherwise could be construed as an intentional intrusion. Was their intent?
Right. Now, is that the intent? And then you have to go look at the specific words in the states and how those states have interpreted those words. Was the intention to intrude, or was it that it was an intentional act? That is, it wasn't that the file was accidentally left in a bar. It was intentionally posted online that had the result of intruding on the seclusion, and in a way that was highly offensive to a reasonable person. The intent here, you'd have to look at the particular state, the particular wording of the law. Is it, was the intention to commit the tort, or was it an intentional act that resulted in the tort? Did you intend to hit the person in the face, or did you intend to throw the ball? Right. So, again, not opining, I'm not telling you what the law is, but understanding that we do now have the rights to privacy in state law in an analog world. So, before I get on to some of the newer laws, I had asked you guys to please look at the FTC Enforcement Act. You did, I hope, get this note. So, I am asking you now to volunteer. What cases did you pick and what did you find out? And given how little else work I asked of this class and I asked of this class and I told you about it last class, I would really hope that all of you are prepared to share. I will feel put upon and taken advantage of otherwise. So, a volunteer. Please, I'll start us off. Okay, tell us about what happened with ChoicePoint.
ChoicePoint, which basically is a company that, you know, they provide personal financial records different companies. If they subscribe to their services, they get people's
I think I had actually talked about ChoicePoint.
I selected because it affected me, actually, at my last job, because we used ChoicePoint in order to do background checks of our potential clients.
Okay, and did it become more difficult after this case?
It became a bigger problem because, you know, obviously we got the letter from ChoicePoint as to what had happened, and then we had to send out a whole bunch of letters to all of our clients and any potential clients, you know, about what happened. They offer, you know, their free credit services for them, you know, for years,
right,
or whatever, but you get the calls from the clients as to, oh, what happened with the information. I thought everything was supposed to be secure, you know, and it becomes a whole, so what happened was that ChoicePoint really did not do their background work. They didn't vet out enough these supposed companies that were subscribing to their services. They would call in from like these like cell phone lines, whatever, saying that the company's phone number was this number, or, you know, they would be, you know, it was just a random shot. They didn't like really go and visit these companies that were supposed to be customers. They should go to visit them. They should have background checks on that to see if they were really legitimate companies that were looking. So what happened was they basically gave out this information to these companies, and they had at least 800 cases of identity theft that they were hit by. And what happened was the FTC hit them with $10 million in civil penalties and $5 million for consumer redress to try to rectify the situation. And I think they have to go to, I think, 2028 or something like that, but they have to have regular checks. They have to have auditors come in and make sure they're doing things right, they're doing things by the book. I think every couple of months they have to go through these procedures that, you know, that they're following what they're supposed to follow. And it just became really a whole disaster for them, because they had everything. You know, they would have credit card information, they would have social security
Yep. And did you see this? So, consumer redress, $5 million. 14,000 consumers last year got checks who were victims of ChoicePoint's alleged failure. $18.17. So that is the value. They could be cashed directly by the recipients of the checks. How nice. Okay, do you pick up any other cases of interest?
I looked at also the TGX companies, which was not as great, but it was also still a problem. TJX owns stores like Marshall's and TJ Maxx and places like that. And what they do, when customers would go ahead and buy something, you know, you have your credit card information that you would run through their machines, and they would take all this data, and they would store this data in their computer system that they had. But the problem with their computer system was it wasn't secure, they didn't have a firewall attached to it, and none of the data was encrypted. It was all basically out there straight word for word, letter for letter, that anybody, if they knew what they were doing, could get into their systems and take the customer's information.
Jamal, did you want to add something to that? Right. Right. Like, so this is not, BJ's was not unusual in that. So what happened ultimately in TJX?
The TJX also, they got hit. The fine was not as great, but they had sanctions that were hit against them. They had about 455,000 customers who just would return items without, you know, their receipts. So all this other data had to go into the system of driver's licenses and things like that. So they got hit also. And basically, they have to go through for the next 20 years and go through all they have to put in all these secure procedures and everything like that. I didn't see where they had to give back money really to customers like Choice.
Right.
I think they just fell under sanctions and they have to go under more security. And they may have offered, you know, to customers also the credit protection or something like that.
Let's see. Right. Now, there may also have been, now note that FTC coordinated its investigation of TJX with 39 state attorneys general, and there could have also been fines, and there may have been civil court cases, too.
Right. It started out, they first discovered it, I think, in Massachusetts, and then they saw it really just spread.
Yep.
2,500 stores across the country, and even into Canada.
Dominic, which cases caught your eye?
The Dave and Buster's case is the first one I wrote.
Okay, so tell us about Dave and Buster's, other than the fact that it's a very loud place to go with your kids.
Their website, the corporate side website, was unsecured, and a hacker was able to, I don't know if, it was kind of unclear if he actually got the information or he just could have accessed the information for 130,000 plus customers' credit and debit cards. And it didn't give an exact number, but thousands of dollars worth of fraudulent charges were made. And the reason behind it was that in addition to not having very good security on the corporate side website, Dave & Buster's didn't have anything to monitor whether or not anybody else was accessing the site. And the FTC made Dave & Buster's make significant upgrades to the system. They had to install new monitoring software. They had to, and they have to be subject to audits on the website. They could have random check-ins to make sure that they're doing everything by the books.
Any others?
That seems to be like the standard approach that they use as these companies get it.
Well,
now you have to follow these rules.
Right. Now, understand something. There is no, Senator Blumenthal's proposal is still just a proposal, and certainly a few years ago, absent whether it's the securities industry or hospitals, there are no formal legislative obligations with regard to computer security and data protection. There's no general requirement to encrypt stored credit card numbers. There's no general requirement to change passwords from the router default. There isn't. But yet, now, Dave and Buster's, BJ's, go down the list, TJX, they are now legally obligated under penalty of default judgment, contempt, etc. And often, the way that the FTC does things, sometimes it levies fines, but holds them in abeyance. Basically, it's like a suspended sentence. You will be liable for this amount if, and not necessarily in these cases, but I've seen this elsewhere, if you don't keep your nose clean. I knew of someone who was personally investigated by the Justice Department and things like that. Ultimately, it was galactic stupidity and not actual criminality that this person had done. And so the rather significant financial penalty was essentially held and said, okay, this is now over your head. We're not going to make you pay it unless. But yeah, so they are now mandating technological decisions in the name of consumer protection. So it wasn't, so with the Dave and Buster's, it wasn't what we saw in BJ's. What we saw in BJ's was the point of sale terminals in the stores were not encrypted. They were, you know, easily, but there can be another entryway, which is the back office systems, not in the retail place, right? That's what happened here. It's not that the, you know, in between the digital bowling things and the giant screen TVs and the claw machines that you can never win and all those other things, people were picking up the signals. No, it was corporate headquarters where all the financial transactions were stored. There they had insufficient security, right? And so the FTC, which is not the Federal Technology Commission, nevertheless is mandating technological requirements in the name of consumer protection. Good. Pete, anything caught your eye? Okay. Tell us about anything different from in Petco?
Not really. They had a policy that said that they would protect consumer information to customers who use their website and buy things.
Okay, so this was a privacy policy issue.
Right.
Okay, so what happened here?
And the FTC said that the information that was available through the website was not encrypted and that the website was vulnerable to common desperate attacks.
Okay. So here we begin to move into this is not nearly as ephemeral, I think, as some of the other cases. Look at what Petco said. And this is why, in a couple of weeks, when we talk specifically about consumer privacy, I'm going to spend a lot of time talking to you about how to word a privacy policy and how that should be done. Because look what Petco said. At Petco.com, these were the words. This was not the FTC saying what it should have done. This was Petco saying what it did do. At Petco.com, protecting your information is our number one priority, and your personal information is strictly shielded from unauthorized access. Entering your credit card number via our secure server is completely safe. The server encrypts all of your information. No one except you can access it. Let's set aside the issue of hacking. Anybody see a factual problem there? Why are people entering their credit card numbers? What? But step back. Why are people giving their credit card numbers to Petco.com? No.
To buy something.
Oh, okay. And in order to buy something, what has to happen to that credit card number?
It has to be transferred.
Right. It has to be used to communicate with the issuing bank by Petco, and Petco needs to say, issuing bank, this account owes us for, you know, food, this amount of money. No one except you can access your personal... No, Petco can. The issuing bank can. So right away, even before you get to the claims that might have been made about security that were inaccurate and therefore misleading, right? Unfair. This is flat out wrong. Inaccurate. It's not about technology, it's about process. This is we will not share your information with third parties. It's a different set of words. The server encrypts, no one except you, the consumer, can access your information. Nonsense. Never true. Nor would the consumer want it to be true.
On that server.
As provided to them.
But the server encrypts and no one can access the
Petco can.
Encrypted server.
Petco can. It better, or else you're not going to be able to get your pet food. So, it doesn't say, but it's not a question of, one can say in this language, we only provide access in order to fulfill transactions. It's a very general statement. It's a safe one. That's not what this says. This is a blanket, blunt, inaccurate statement. No one except you can access, what is the it, English? Your information. Implied from the previous sentence, credit card number. This is clearly not true. Was it done maliciously? No. No. It was probably either copied from someone else who got it wrong. And I'm not maligning Petco to say that, because that's the way these things develop. Or it was drafted by a lawyer, or even worse, a client trying to be a lawyer, who didn't understand the plain meaning, didn't think about the plain meaning of these words. What were they actually trying to say? That we use SSL, secure socket layer, I think it is, encryption between your computer and our computer. Along the way, it's encrypted, which it will be. It cannot be intercepted successfully. That's what was happening. Once it was sitting there, it was not encrypted. Yes, it was safe to enter the number because in the transmission, it was completely safe. It was encrypted. Once it was sitting there, however, no. And right? And that's what happened. It was sitting just like in the carbon paper era, credit card slips were collected in boxes. And the numbers were there and the signatures were there. And yes, you know, you will hand us no one but our waiters will receive your credit card or swipe them. That could be true. But if we leave them in the dumpster in the back, anybody can get them after the fact. That is essentially what's going on here. It's just the digital version. And whether or not Petco would have been liable for failing to take adequate precautions in a vacuum, the way that BJ's was or TJX was, we're not even getting there. They said they were doing it and they weren't. Technically inaccurate. It matters. The agency charge, first of all, says the website was vulnerable to commonly known web-based application attacks. Petco created these vulnerabilities in its website by failing to implement reasonable and appropriate security measures to secure and protect consumer information, including simple, readily available defenses that would have blocked such attack. So what was violated in the disclosure? Your personal information is strictly shielded from unauthorized access. No, it isn't, because they didn't bother to lock the drawers. And then the second step, the agency also charged the sensitive information Petco obtained through its website was not maintained in an encrypted format, as it claimed. Therefore, a hacker, as a result, a hacker was able to penetrate the Petco website, access credit card numbers, stored in unencrypted clear text. Once you could get to the file, because they didn't take any of the normal security provision measures to block it, it was right there. It was just a database, like database of patient names and diagnosis codes. Here we have a database of credit card numbers. And so, therefore, the FTC charged that Petco's claims were deceptive and violated the FTC Act. There's the jurisdiction. There's the claim. Any others catch your eye in addition to Petco?
Looks like the Google Buzz.
Okay, Google Buzz is an interesting. Tell us about Google Buzz quickly. So what was Google Buzz? Could you tell, or do you know?
It was a social networking program that Google started with their Gmail users.
Right.
And they made it look like they were giving users the option to opt out of the program, but they collected information and used it from Gmail users without really letting them know about.
Right. So once you were into Buzz, whether or not you said you wanted things disclosed, other people in your network saw what you were doing, you saw what they were doing. It wasn't built in a way that preserved the privacy as Google said it would. So, on the day Buzz was launched, Gmail users got a message announcing the new service and were given two options. Sweet, check out Buzz, or nah, go to my inbox. However, the FTC complaint alleged that some Gmail users who clicked on nah, you know, you got to figure the people who are writing these are like, all those Silicon Valley types, nah, were nonetheless enrolled in certain features of the Google Buzz social network. For those Gmail users who clicked on sweet, the FTC alleged that they were not adequately informed that the identity of individuals they emailed most frequently would be made public by default. Google also offered a turn-off Buzz option that did not fully remove the user from the social network. How many of you are users of Google Buzz? None of you! I can say that with certainty because in the aftermath of this, Google killed Buzz. What's interesting here, and this leads into our next discussion, which is social network privacy. Two things. One, this, you know, that here we have a social network case. This was not about credit card numbers. This was about sharing information in a social network. It also happens to mention the EU Safe Harbor Framework, which I think I briefly mentioned, which we will get back to when we talk about international law, that different countries, different laws, and there are questions of what promises what a company makes about protecting under U.S. law and whether that will permit the company to legally move information to and from Europe. But look here. What else? So this settlement happened, so the charge was March of this year. So not only do we have a case about a social network, but where did the FTC spread the word about the case? Transcript of the FTC Priv Twitter question and answer. I think I was on that day. The FTC has become a phenomenally active user of the Twitter service for press conferences, for discussions. It's a really interesting thing to watch. But it has its own guidelines about government social media use, which are really worth looking at. I'll probably send you a link to those. But so this was social network case discussed on a different social network. Good, thank you. Francis, did you have a chance to look at any particular cases?
Yeah.
Okay.
Where the company And the FTC took action against them, and they settled the matter, and disgorgement of profits was the remedy.
Okay, so people sell phone, you know. Interesting. So were they actually selling the contents of the phones? The phone messages?
I believe they were selling the activity or...
Whom they called, who called them.
Right.
Hold that thought. Hold that thought. Because there, right, there's an idea here. Well, we also have some issues about financial information. And how they got the information was a little bit dicey. But there's an idea here that, not only is there an idea, there's a legal basis why whom you called and who called you should be treated at least somewhat privately. Confidential phone records. Keep that in mind. We'll get to that. Does Melanie cases strike your interest? Mrs. Fields. Okay, so you went to the children's privacy. Okay, I'm going to ask you, I appreciate that. We're going to post, hold on to that one. Please remember to talk more about it. I guess it's in 2 weeks or two classes when we get to children's privacy. Were there any others that you, that weren't children's related? Okay, good. So Experian credit were credit records,
right?
And what was the violation there?
They, well, the Congress, they had amended the federal, a Fair Credit Reporting Act.
Right.
So that the reporting agencies needed to set up a telephone line for anyone who called in to get their credit report.
Okay. So this was not about electronic communications privacy. This was about a specific requirement under the Fair Credit Reporting Act, right? The FCRA, which covers credit issuance, credit records, who may access credit reports, for what purpose, and so on. And there are obligations on those companies, generally, I guess it's, at least then it was Experian, TransUnion, and Equifax. I think they don't, at least one of them has changed the name since then, maybe. But anyway, that required, so the statute was changed to require these three companies to provide consumers who receive a copy of their credit report with a toll-free telephone number at which personnel are accessible to consumers during normal business hours. A method of redress, questions, concerns. And the complaint was that nobody ever picked up. Right? So they may have had a number, but they didn't effectively implement this. Okay. So that's sort of an interesting situation, right? Where there was a federal statute that was not appropriately implemented. So we have the ideas with the general fairness, unfairness. We have Mrs. Fields, which we'll set aside, which had a specific children's privacy law. And here we have the Fair Credit Reporting Act. What this really gets to is the idea that there isn't one place to look. There are a lot of different laws, regulations, etc., that collectively address issues of data collection, data use, data sharing. And in counseling clients, one has to consider all of them, or at least as many as one can think of. A few examples in practice. One of the clients that I've worked with over the years is in the business of sharing, of qualifying loan leads. People want loans, auto loans, home loans, whatever it is. There are lenders out there. Lenders pay companies to find them potential borrowers. Often they may be people who have less than stellar credit, etc. Or they may be looking for a car or a home in a particular region, and the lender, I mean, if you want to think about sort of the top level lending tree, right? What is the business of lendingtree.com? Well, it is twofold. One is it finds, it matches borrowers with lenders, and not incidentally, it runs its own lending operation that will be one of the choices issued. But you also have players that are on much smaller scale. So this was a client that was in the business of creating websites to advertise, to find, and pre-qualify potential borrowers, and then send them, based on certain criteria, to one or more lenders. That was the business. So the client came to us and asked us sort of general, what do we need to do with privacy? So first question, and again, we'll get back to children's privacy, is are you asking their age? If you're asking their age, and you might have an under 13 person, whether or not that person should be borrowing money, if you collect that information, children's privacy laws may apply. Okay, fine. Next question. What do you say you're doing with the information, making sure your disclosure is accurate? Privacy policy. But then the question came up, how is it, client, that you are pre-qualifying these potential borrowers? What standards are you using? Is it just geographic? No, it turned out that in order to make the service worthwhile to the lenders, the client was obtaining basic credit reports about these potential borrowers. And while it was not itself issuing the loans, okay, so you get this idea, website. Someone wants to borrow money for a car, house, whatever it is. Comes to the website, yes, I'm interested in borrowing this money. Answer a few very basic informational questions. Who are you? Where do you live? What's your phone number, basically? It's all they need, right? Because when you look at whether it's TransUnion or you look at ChoicePoint, they know they can get this stuff on very little. So then our client would go and contract with a credit reporting agency to score this person. And based on the score, would choose to pass to lender A or lender B or lender C. Or not. So we said to the client, you do know this, or didn't know. Dear client, one of the things, now that you are, even though you're not in the business of lending, but one of the things that the FCRA says about credit report use is if a party obtains a credit report, and as a result of that credit report makes a negative decision not to lend, for that matter, not to hire. There are jobs where people run your credit. The party is obligated to give the potential employee borrower notice, formal notice of this negative action, adverse action letter, they call it, adverse action notice. We checked your credit report. We've decided not to lend to you, not to hire to you, etc. We had to answer the question that was not particularly clear, and I'm not going to get into the facts, specific facts. Our client was not making a lending decision or hiring decision, but it was making the decision of whether to pass it on to a lender or not. Was our client obligated to send adverse action notices? Or to get the lenders to send them, because ultimately the decision was in part based on a credit report. I know that was, there's a lot of pieces there. But we had to look at, because our client was touching the lending industry and touching credit reports, even though it was not a lender. Never, we had to determine whether we had to research it, find this adverse action notice obligation and figure out, does it apply to our client or not? And if so, has our client do it in some affordable way? These are not straightforward questions. So I just wanted to share that with you. When we're talking about all these different contexts, one cannot always know that your client is a pet food owner store. Therefore, the Federal Fair Credit Reporting Act might not apply. Or the children's privacy might. They may still apply. You really have to look at all the potential exposure, how likely it is, how not, how expensive compliance is versus taking the risk. All right. Questions? Okay. Shifting gears. Take a breath. Okay. We saw in looking at what Brandeis and Warren had to say, and ultimately today I showed you what Prosser showed. And so we have in the analog era. In the analog era, we had issues of photography, issues of voice recordings, issues of newspaper stories, and we saw the torts and the laws that were required, and they were fairly basic and straightforward. But we've also discussed over the last few sessions the challenges of electronics and digital. And so what I want to do briefly, and I know you haven't looked at these statutes yet, and ultimately we will be returning to them, and we'll talk about, when we get closer to December 22nd, to what extent I think it's fair, you know, I want you to understand them and know them well. But I want to at least begin talking to you today about the digital statutes, the general ones, the ones that are on the books and have been for quite some time. As electronic communications, that gets defined, started becoming prevalent, as we moved from telephone lines, where it was one person to one person with at most an operator in between, to telephone systems, where you had multiple lines, and you had voicemail, and you had cellular phones, and conference calls, and voice over IP, voice over the internet. And as we moved from radio to television to two-way video, and certainly as we moved from postal mail and telegraphs to telex, facsimile, and ultimately electronic messaging, which could be stored digitally and shared and duplicated, and you can have thousands of records and they could be stolen and stored. As these developments that we've talked about already came up, Congress realized that the existing laws with regard to privacy, to the extent there were any, were insufficient. That there had been case, for example, there had been case law and statute about wiretapping. For most Americans, the word wiretaps began to come into play with probably the Watergate hearings and things like that. But even before that, but that was still one call, one line, one tap. But we went beyond just watching messages and listening to them or knowing which numbers were dialed to and from pen registers to the idea of stored communications. And looking even at wiretaps, a wiretap, the definition was talking about a telephone call. But what about a text message? What about an email message going across? What about video? Does it count the same way? So Congress passed and then has revised the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, ECPA. And within ECPA, and I'm going to be posting these, so these ref, you know, just in terms of note-taking, the PowerPoint will be up. Within ECPA, it's divided up, and I think I've briefly introduced this to you in a previous class, three major portions, depending on what's being done and when. So the Wiretap Act, which is not just about wiretaps, but all monitoring of communications as they happen, and specifically focusing on the what is being said part, the content, whether it's intercepting an email message or listening in on a telephone call. So that's the Wiretap Act. The Penn Register Statute, which isn't really about those machines that would count the number of clicks and figure out what number is being dialed, but it is broader to all of the non-watching a message as it happens, a communication, but looking at the non-content stuff, not what was being said, by whom, to whom, when, where, etc. And all that, how it is protected or not, is covered by the Penn Register Statute. And finally, and this really is new, or was new, the notion of stored communications, stored electronic communications. They didn't exist before the 70s and the 80s in any real way, so we didn't need laws about them. But once they became common, suddenly we needed to know who was entitled to access them, who wasn't, whether we're talking about law enforcement or the service providers, under what circumstances. So we have these different parts. Now, again, separate from constitutional protections, we're not talking about Fourth Amendment issues. Those still apply, or may not apply, but this is specific federal criminal statutes. Generally speaking, ECPA goes back to 1986. Not that long ago when you think about law. What are we talking now? 35 years? 25 years? 25 years. Not even 35. 25 years, right? To do the math. Think about how old I was. Still too old. 1986. Not that long ago. Right? The original laws predating ECPA were about wired voice and telegraph communications. So ECPA comes in. The Wiretap Act had already existed. It was revised and updated. The Penn Register Statute, there was general law, mostly case law. It created it, and it created the Stored Communications Act. And these words are sort of how the scholars define the difference. Prospective, retrospective, fancy words for while it's happening, once it's finished. Are we listening as it's, or reading as it's going across? Or is it stored somewhere and we need to find out what was said? Content, non-content. What was said, to whom? So depending on the circumstance, is it content or non-content? Oh, okay, it's content. Is it prospective or retrospective? Is it now or then? It's happening now. Content, so we're talking about those. Content, prospective, which of the three? Wiretap. Content, retrospective, what was said afterwards? Stored communications. And non-content, prospective, while it's happening? Pen register. Non-content, retrospective. Afterwards, which one? Stored communications. What about files saved on a computer? Documents. There's a key question. How'd they get there? If they were typed on that computer, none of the above. This is a key question that trips up people who are in cybercrime, right? Where this also comes up. What's our key phrase here? communications. These laws are not about malicious hacking. That's the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. These laws are not about the privacy of documents, per se, of your computer, your laptop. These laws are specific about communications. So in order for any of these to apply, information has to have gone from person A to person B, point A to point B. A document that was attached to an email falls under this. A document that was typed in place does not. Important to remember that. So just what I want to do for the rest of the class is to give you the flavor of ECPA. To give you a sense of how it, the words it uses, the things that it permits and prohibits, the kinds of things, because ECPA comes up in all sorts of contexts. It applies to both state actors, police, government officials, when they may or may not access the content, but it also applies to private actors. Internet service providers, Touro College Jacob D. Fuchsberg Law Center IT Department. When must or must not a network administrator keep messages, communications, in process or stored private? When may or must it disclose them? Under what circumstances? Those are the kinds of questions. And what about different kinds of service providers? So let's see. So the law talks about wired communications and electronic communications. So how is an electronic communication defined? Remember, with all statutes, never assume you know what the words mean. Never. They mean whatever it is the drafter said for that particular statute. So it turns out that in 18 U.S. Code, section 2510, subparagraph 12, electronic communications are defined as any transfer of signs, signals, writing, images, sounds, data, or intelligence of any nature, which means that stupid email may not qualify, I'm just kidding, transmitted in whole or in part by a wire, radio, electromagnetic, photoelectronic, or photo-optical system that affects interstate or foreign commerce. That gives us federal jurisdiction. But does not include, so let's first look at this. How do you define electronic communications as broadly as possible? Transfer of signs, signals, writings, images, sounds, data, or intelligence. Pretty broad in terms of content. Things that can be transmitted. How? In whole or in part by a wire, radio, electromagnetic, photoelectronic, or photo-optical system. Fiber optics. Fios. That is not, it's not a wire, it's not a radio, it's not electromagnetic, it's actually photo-optical and photoelectronic. It's little light beams in little dots, essentially dots and dashes, zeros and ones. So they had come, so the statute has to come up with at least, well, if we get to telepathy, we have a problem. Unless it's electromagnetic in some way. You know, if we could do quantum teleportation and we've now matched two quanta and changing one changes the other. They're doing this stuff, right? They're going to have to revise this. Because if one could send information through the manipulation of individual quantum particles, I'm not sure it counts as any of those. But for now, this pretty much covers what we would consider electronic, except any wire or oral communication. Why? Because those are covered by a separate law. So if it's wire communication that falls under things like wire fraud, any communication made through a tone-only paging device. Tone-only, we probably don't even have those anymore. What's a tone-only paging device? Whatever it is, it doesn't count. Even though it's using a radio signal, all it's doing is going beep. right? Any communication from a tracking device, now there, we'll get into that, or electronic funds transfer information stored by a financial institution in a communication system used for the electronic storage and transfer of funds. Why do you think this law excludes? Aren't these important communications? Because it's probably covered by something else, financial regulation. So we've already dealt with that. We don't want conflicts. But otherwise, pretty broad definition. So yeah, we think about what kinds of communications fall under this. And specifically consider that time period, the period beginning around 1986. 1986. How old were some of you? Well, you guys are a little more established in your lives, right? 1986. Those students who are fresh. Anybody here a fresh face out of college? But here, anyone?
I'm close. I was born in 1986.
Okay. So there you have it. There's your fresh face, right? So, when you were born and your parents wanted to spread the news, they didn't send emails, did they? One would imagine. They picked up the phone. They had to pick it up because, well, maybe it was attached. Maybe they had to pull up an antenna. They were cordless phones. Very few people had cell phones in 1986. And if they did, they were usually in a bag. Right? That was about when cell phones were really invented. So this was a time when things were changing. If you wanted to send text, you know, a document from one place to another, and I know I sound like I'm talking about the Stone Age, but understand it matters for law. How did you send, how did your parents send the text if they didn't want to put, you know, and they happen to have access to it? How do you send text in 1986? Nobody knows. What?
A fax.
Fax machines were common in 1986. Usually thermal paper, but fax machines. Or telex, which was sort of like email before there was email. If you look at old business cards, usually from big corporations, they'll list a little telex thing. But, right? So, and how did you send video? You didn't send video. At best, if your parents recorded your birth on their camcorder, they had to put a tape into the mail because the only people who could send video were networks, broadcasting, television stations. We didn't have access to video. Yes, in 1964, at the World's Fair in Flushing Meadows, the phone company, right, Bell, told us all we'd be doing video calls. Now we are, but it took, you know, 40 plus years to make it so that grandma can actually do video conferencing. It wasn't happening for a long time. So consider this transition. And where there are similarities, it's not just a matter of sort of interesting technology history. The way they work matters. Because law has to change, enforcement has to change. Pre-1986 or pre-ECPA, to listen in on a telephone call, you tapped the line. You know, conference calls really weren't multipoint. Now we have multipoint. Many people all at once. Where do you listen in? You send one message, it goes lots of places. Real-time versus stored. The late 80s, people were first buying answering machines. They had cassettes in them. Voicemail really didn't exist anywhere but maybe in the biggest corporations. Voice communications weren't stored centrally. Now they are. Totally different question of, where do you find out what was said? Right? In the answering machine era, if a police officer an investigator wanted access to a message left, where did that person have to go? Where did that person have to go? Physically. Had to go to the person's house with a warrant and get the answering machine. Today, you want someone's messages, where do you go? Where can you go? You go to the phone company. There is no answering machine. We have voicemail. It's sitting somewhere centrally. So, before that, one or the other of the people involved in that conversation became very quickly aware. Now, not so much. We don't necessarily know. That's why when in the mid-aughts, 5-6 years ago, when the warrantless wiretapping scandal broke, the idea was that the authorities were able to work with the service providers and the customers had no clue that their communications were being monitored, because we don't know. Voice versus data, video, audio. What was communicated from normal citizen to normal citizen? Voice calls. Normal citizens didn't have fax machines. Normal citizens didn't have television broadcasts. Normal citizens could not send 20,000 or 400,000 credit card numbers without a truck. Things have changed. So the laws that and the process and the procedures that were created for listening in have changed. Where it happens, how it happens, what are we listening for? If the law is about voice calls and it doesn't give authority to monitoring video or files, got a problem as a law enforcement agent, or vice versa. Encryption. At best, the encryption technology was speaking in code. Now, it can literally be mathematically impossible for the average law enforcement officer to listen in to intercept a communication or unscramble, because whether or not TJX or BJ's or Petco has turned on encryption, the bad guys have. And a lot of the good guys have too, because they want privacy. And so we have a lot of crossovers, like voice over IP, internet protocol. When you use Skype or Vonage or Google Voice to communicate, or FaceTime, or pick your favorite service, is it... Which type of communication is it? Is it a telephone call? Do we look up the law for telephone calls? Or is it more akin to an email message? Arguments can be made for both. Freaking, hacking, and cloning. Wonderful words. No, this is not a typo. Before we had computer networks, we had telephone systems. And before malicious hackers, or just because hackers were messing with the computer networks, before WikiLeaks, before Anonymous, we had people with Captain Crunch whistles.
Captain Crunch whistles?
One of the oldest and most established hacker journals. It's called 2600. It used to be published in paper. Now, generally, it's online. It is not a reference to the original Atari 2600 game system, but rather to 2600 megahertz or kilohertz. I don't remember which. Frequency. In the early 1970s, the way that the telephone system computers were programmed, were set up, one could bypass the need to pay for calls to a particular tone. It was all tone-based, touch tone. Right? You could put in certain tones, or if you were a worker for the phone company and you needed to test something, you had a device that would play a certain sound, and that sound would trigger access to something. Okay. Turned out that sound was 2600 again. It's whether it's kilohertz either or megahertz, whatever the frequency is. The Cap'n Crunch cereal box in the early 70s once gave out a whistle. And it turns out that that whistle happened to play at this frequency. And early hackers, early people who liked to mess and see what the phone system could be made to do, discovered that if they got these toy whistles from the cereal box, they could literally make phone calls without paying for them. So, you know, we have this idea where it's a telephone call, but there are computers running it, the system, and you can mess with the computers and therefore get access to the voice network. Hacking. There are computers. We will use our phones to connect our computers to those other computers and get access to them. And if you want to see the Hollywood version of that, go find Matthew Broderick's breakout film, War Games. I remember hearing once that the computer system in his bedroom probably would have been about $800,000 or something. But he had his computer dialing other computers on the phone and eventually woke up Joshua, the whopper, and go see the movie. Then you had cloning, not in the Dolly the Sheep sense, but in the early days of cell phones. The early days of cell phones, they connected through unencrypted analog signals. And they would basically, as you were driving along, your phone would call out to the nearest cell phone tower and identify itself in the clear. Here's who I am, here's which phone I am, here's the number that gets charged for these calls. And you had enterprising criminals, because this really was criminal, that would basically park on an overpass over a highway with, you know, decently powerful radio receivers tuned to those frequencies that the cell phones used. And as the drivers were driving along, making the calls, their phones would reach out to the towers, their phones would identify themselves, the cloners would record those electronically, take those exact identifiers, put them onto brand new blank cell phones, sell them for cheap or use them themselves, and suddenly, while your phone was still, I wouldn't say in your pocket because it was probably very big and bulky, while your phone was still in your presence, an identical phone from the system's perspective that you've never seen was making calls being billed to your account. So what is that? You know, this idea of, so now we're using, but our phones have computers. And we're hacking into the software on our phones. So you have all this crossover from a law enforcement perspective, from a legislative perspective, definitions using, so we have a lot of these things. It gets confusing. So as I said, I just want to introduce you to give you a sense of these laws. So the Wiretap Act, we're talking about intercepting communications as they happen, and prospectively, and specifically looking at what's being said, the content of the message. So what are our definitions? So this is what is prohibited, right? This is just, if when you look up 18 USC, you want to look this up, here's your guide to where to find things. So take the slides if you're curious. We have definitions. The general principle, interception and disclosure of wire, oral, or communications, prohibited. Prohibition of use as evidence of intercepted wire. So this is essentially, while the exclusionary rule does not apply particularly, right, you're aware of this Fourth Amendment, if police in investigating violate the Fourth Amendment rules, the evidence gained from that violation and anything derived thereafter, the fruit of the poisonous tree, is excluded I hope you've all been introduced to this notion. Yes? Criminal law, constitutional law, you know, that's... But, so here, generally, there is a similar prohibition. They may not be used as evidence if it was intercepted in violation. Except, there are times when it is authorized to intercept, whether by police or by private individuals. And there are times when it's authorized for that content to be disclosed and used. General no, limited yes. When, how, and why? So we talked about the how. But then you have to think about, okay, so we want to intercept it. This law is about transmission. When does transmission occur? There are cases where there's one particular case that comes up under this law. Here are the facts. Computer. Keyboard. Someone puts a device, a keylogger, a device on the keyboard between the keyboard and the computer that records everything being typed into that computer. Through that keylogger, the content of a message is captured as it's being typed. Do the provisions of the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, the Wiretap Act, apply? Why wouldn't they? Let's go back a bit. What about our definitions? Scroll. Any transfer, right? Transmitted, there's your key word. Transmitted. In order for something to be covered as electronic communication, it must be transmitted. So, is or is not the content of a message as it's typed on its way to the computer considered transmitted? The answer in that particular case is no. It was going to be, but it hadn't yet been. It was captured before it was transmitted. Yeah, it's an electric signal from the keyboard. No, that's not what this, how this is interpreted. But you see, functionally, it's identical. It's a signal, it's a wire, but where it happens matters. Here's another fun one. We differentiate between contents and non-contents. Well, what represents content? The email header, the to, the from. Is that content or non-content, do you think? None, okay. But what about the subject line? That's part of the header. Anybody ever send an email message that's just the subject line? Quick note? Sure. Also, where you're sending may sometimes be content. A URL, a website address, content or non-content?
I guess it depends on really what's in
there. Right. As I think you've already seen, I think in some of the reading, stuff that I've been writing, sometimes when you do a search, right, the page address includes the words of the search. Right. Packet sniffers. We're watching these packets, these little bits of information going across, which ones are covered. So we need to understand it. Don't forget there's a consent exception. But whatever the prohibitions are, a party may consent. But who's a party? Sender, recipient, the internet service provider along the way? Is Touro Law Center that reserves the right to read all communications you send a party? It's not so. If you send an email to 25 people, are all of them entitled to consent? Do all of them need to? It's not so clear. Providers who are running their networks sometimes need to look in order to make sure it's running properly, or because law enforcement requires them to do so. And so there are exceptions here. Someone's hacking into your network, you need to watch out for the hacker. You're allowed to intercept that person's communications. Computer trespassers. Pen register, again, is about the non-content stuff, the equivalent of the phone number. The requirements are less stringent in terms of the procedural requirements. Location information. Yeah? This is where, when we get into social networks, where you are has suddenly become part of the message. Is that considered content or non-content? And is it in fact less sensitive? Stored communications get after the fact. They set standards for when investigators may get things from administrators. There are different kinds of providers, and the definitions are here. Whether the main business is communications or you're talking about remote computing where there is communication as part of that. Not always clear which is which, but if you read through ECPA, through the Stored Communications Act, the laws are slightly different for electronic communication services or remote computing services. And we will come back to that. You'll see in the slides, these are sort of the general prohibitions about that it's prohibited to disclose, but there are exceptions, which I would recommend you look at. Sometimes things are required. And we talked about these things. Okay. For next class, the social media draft chapter. Now, I've started to do something since I'm in the process of writing. I know you guys are diligent and want to get a handle on the reading. So it occurred to me, technology has made something really cool or uncool happen, I'm not sure. I store my stuff on Dropbox. You have access now, not the introductory chapter, but this one and the next one, to the draft as it exists at the moment. So by next week, you can start now on the social media chapter. There's a link to where it is. You'll be able to read it. The location part is still in formation. It should be done hopefully by the end of the weekend, but you can get started on it. The children's privacy chapter is also there. As my drafting happens, you will have access to it in real time, for better or for worse. But it'll allow you to write, to read, to start reading going forward. I know this is a little awkward, and I apologize for it. But I would strongly ask you to give me feedback because the book may change because of what you tell me. It's meant for you guys. So that's there. And I would also ask you to please, since we're talking about social media and privacy, go read and think about the privacy policies of Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, and Foursquare, which is foursquare.com, and see what they do and do not promise, what they do and do not say about data, etc., and be ready to talk about it. Questions? Have a good one.